You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Journalist, cultural critic, and film historian Mark Harris returns to the show this week. He's the author of Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, which was also a series on Netflix. And his latest work is Mike Nichols, A Life. Mark Harris, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for making time for my little show now that you're in the big time. It must be so exciting, you know, to have such a great reception for Mike Nichols' A Life. I mean, you were on Colbert. There was a big piece in New Yorker.
It's a great feeling. And I think it's I'm surprised by how much attention the book has gotten. But that's really, I think, a tribute to its subject. I mean, I'm thrilled to know that there are this many people who are curious about Mike Nichols and his life, because, of course, I think it's a really unique life and one that was worth 4 years of my life plus to explore.
Well, you've written other books, but you've never written a biography, a full length biography before. Was that a daunting task? And how did it come about?
Well, to answer the second question first, it came about after Mike died, which was in December of 2014. My publisher approached me and asked if I might be interested in this. And as I started to think about it, I realized that I was very interested. But yes, it was a daunting task, because a biography is, I knew going in, but discovered every day, a real different beast from what I had done before. Both of my first two books involved five or six main characters in a fairly compressed period of time, 5 or 6 years. And the challenge of those books was to kind of be the orchestra conductor and give everyone their solo and know when to push one plot line into the background and cut to another. So in some ways, at first I thought writing a biography will be very easy, because there are no structural questions to answer. It's one life in order. What a breeze that'll be for me. I very soon discovered that that was not the case at all. I left the process really in awe of what biographers do, because I discovered that it was a really tricky line to walk even well before I started writing. I felt this in research, that there's this constant tension between wanting to create a compelling narrative for readers so that a life just doesn't come across as a kind of disconnected chronological sequence of events. And at the same time, honoring the reality that lives themselves are not narratives, and that they do take odd, unexpected turns that a fiction writer would never plot. And everything isn't completely linearly explicable by the thing that happened just before it. So trying to stay true to the reality of a life and still tell a compelling story. I think it's what all biographers face, really. And I'm excited now to read different biographies. Now that I can't change a word in mine, I suddenly have a big appetite to see how other people do it. Obviously I'd read them before, but now I'm curious in a new way.
Right. Because you've written one. So do you think you'll write another biography?
I don't know. I'm rooting around right now to figure out what the next book might be. And I have two ideas that are sort of gestating, and neither one of them is a biography, but often for me, the road to a book subject is circuitous and full of detours. So it could be that neither of these two ideas will pan out, and that one of them will in fact lead to a biography. I certainly wouldn't rule it out. But I do really like, I discovered, for all the structural challenges that the first two books presented to me. It's really fun having a large and ongoing cast of characters to play with. I mean, Mike Nichols turned out to have a fascinating life at every stage. I mean, the book is 35 chapters, and there honestly isn't one chapter in there that I went into feeling like, oh, nothing much happens in this chapter. I just have to get through it to get to the next one. Like, they all interested me. But the hard thing about his life is that it's this cast of hundreds of all-stars, you know, but it's an ever-changing cast with a few exceptions. Diane Sawyer, Meryl Streep, Elaine May. There are a lot of supporting characters in the book who get the spotlight on them for a chapter or two, but who then disappear, because that's the nature of a director's life when you move from project to project. And I miss a little bit having a large ongoing cast of characters to play with.
Well, you're such a great storyteller, and that comes through in all of your books, including Mike Nichols Alive. But I think with Mike Nichols Alive, we don't follow him home all that much. It's mostly a professional biography. I mean, you talk about him having kids and being married four times, but we don't go into the bedroom or into his family life all that much.
Yeah, I'm not really a go into the bedroom kind of writer, I think. I hope that readers get a pretty intimate glimpse of his first marriage, which really was not written about a lot. And the intimacy of that, of the account in my book, is partly due to the fact that his first wife, who is still alive and well, was kind enough to talk to me. So I really got an understanding of this marriage at a crucial point in his life, which is when he goes from struggling to famous. His second wife, who he was married to for 11 years, but only with for less than a year — they were separated for almost all of their marriage — was kind of an enigma even to people who knew Mike at the time. So I tried to convey that. But yeah, I mean, to some extent, I wanted to give Mike's three children a fairly large zone of privacy, because they're not public people. They didn't ask for this. They were all very kind and, I think, daring in giving me their consent to do this biography and asking for nothing in return, not asking for any veto power, not asking to read it in advance, not asking that any subjects be left out. And perhaps someday someone will write an intimate account of Mike as a father, but it wasn't really the thing that I was after in doing this book. And so, yes, they show up on the periphery of his professional life, which is where they were.
Mm-hmm. It's let's just talk about The Graduate for a minute, because you've already written about The Graduate in another book quite extensively. So were you able to cannibalize any part of Pictures at a Revolution for your reason?
I had to, in a way, because for Pictures at a Revolution, I was, I really did sort of plow the field as diligently as I could. I talked to everyone I possibly could about The Graduate, who had made The Graduate, who was available to me. And so it wasn't as if I were going to be able to magically discover a whole trove of new information about The Graduate, or stuff that I had just decided wasn't interesting enough to tell you in a book that was actually about The Graduate. But, there were two things in the book that I found really going in very unnerving to have to do. And one of them was to write about The Graduate again. And I'm really pleased by the fact that it seems to be a favorite part of the book for people who haven't read my first book, which is really what I wanted. That if you didn't know the account of The Graduate that I had already told, that this be as exciting to you as it was to me the first time I was able to pull it together. That said, I did find some new material, and also I was able to frame it in a slightly different way than the first book, because this is really 100% the account of Mike Nichols approaching The Graduate and making The Graduate. So, for instance, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which gets a couple of pages in my first book, gets a much fuller account in this book. And so you understand, I think, a lot more about who Mike Nichols was as a director coming into The Graduate in this biography than you might have understood if you just read Pictures of a Revolution.
I want to ask about, so, you know, the thing that's happening now in 2021 and 2020 is looking at films in a different way. People have, you know, now they are enlightened and they see things in films that we didn't see. I mean, you could watch a Pepe Le Pew cartoon now and suddenly see it as a terrible exploitation of sexual assault. So when people look at The Graduate now, and I teach film appreciation, and my students are always telling me their thoughts about it. People don't, I mean, when I saw The Graduate when it came out, and I loved it, and all of my friends loved it, and we loved the enigmatic ending. But today's audiences judge it more harshly. They don't see Benjamin as a sympathetic character as much. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, to the extent that they don't see Benjamin, I mean, on the overall question of you know, that you're asking, the larger question of judgment, yeah, I have a problem with judging the past through the superior lens of the present. The past isn't a series of cultural errors that you are here to assess. It's, you know, not everything should be excused by the fact that it was a different time, but it's the least interesting thing that the least interesting way that you can approach, I think, an older piece of pop culture is with the superiority that comes from the fact that you lived through things and know things that literally had not happened at the time this piece of culture was made. That's just, it's not an interesting cultural perspective. It's not an interesting critical perspective. That said, I think it's really interesting that young audiences now may feel less sympathy with Benjamin, because Nichols himself felt less sympathy with Benjamin than many of the young moviegoers who saw The Graduate in 1967 felt. He did not see the movie as a rallying cry for the young end of the generation gap, and he did not see Benjamin as a kind of countercultural hero. To him, Benjamin was a privileged character who was, according to Mike's account, literally drowning in material things. He comes home and he's surrounded by his parents' wealth and luxury. And even when he disappears into the bottom of a swimming pool, he's still literally immersed in this kind of womb-like world of privilege that his parents have built for him. He's literally sinking to the bottom of the sea in this giant scuba suit that is his graduation present. And so he drifts into this affair with this older woman that Mike and that Buck Henry, who wrote the script, really saw as a kind of spiritual self-annihilation. You know, the affair to them was nothing to celebrate. And then he snaps himself out of it by realizing that he wants something else. He wants someone else. But arguably acts in a really morally questionable way to get it. So Mike was very attuned, even while he was making The Graduate, to the fact that Benjamin is a problematic character. And to use a word that everyone would use now that no one used then, he is problematic. So I think that Mike might have more sympathy with the current view of Benjamin that you're articulating than some of your students might suspect. But, you know, I also think it's the job of someone who's interested in movies to try to understand the lens through which a movie was seen at the time and understand the world in which a movie was made.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Mark Harris. He's a film historian and journalist. His books include Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, and Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War, which was also a Netflix series. His latest book is called Mike Nichols, A Life. And we'll continue our conversation with Mark Harris right after this. Mark Harris, when you consider the film work of Mike Nichols, do you think of him as an auteur?
I think that gets into a really interesting question of what an auteur is, because the way we think of it now, when we think of contemporary directors, we think, well, the Coen brothers are auteurs, or Paul Thomas Anderson is an auteur, or Martin Scorsese is an auteur. And what we tend to mean by that sometimes is that they make a certain kind of movie that makes it very possible for you to see what their obsessions and interests and recurring techniques are from movie to movie. And in many cases, not Scorsese, but a number of others, they also write their movies, which means that their stylistic obsessions and their content interests are very easy to identify. But if we go back to the origins of the auteur theory in the 50s, it was applied a lot to people like Howard Hawks, who didn't write his own movies, worked for studios, made musicals, made westerns, made film noir, and still managed to bring certain distinctive things to those movies while always serving the script, serving the content, like serving the job. So I do think, in a way, Mike was an auteur, if you use that older definition of it, because there are things that are consistent in his work and are really interesting in his work that carry through movies of wildly different genres, from his interest in sexual dynamics between men and women and between men and men, to the way he approaches actors and the way he uses physical behavior in a performance to reveal character, sometimes to underscore a point that's being made in the lines, sometimes to contradict a point that's being made in the dialogue. So I think those are auteurist hallmarks, but his particular brushstrokes are not as overt and apparent as that of many other directors were.
In very early on in his directing career, I think I can't remember exactly, but he was directing something that I think it was something that Jules Pfeiffer had written, and Pfeiffer was impressed with the way Nichols could make the story more human, and that's what you talk about when he directs Neil Simon as well. So what is it exactly that he did with actors that made the comedy that he was directing more realistic and less sitcom-y?
I think it's that it goes back to some of the things that Mike learned as an actor himself in his scenes with Elaine May, that you have to find either elements of physical behavior or elements of emotional behavior that make any situation recognizable and intimate to an audience, that there have to be things in a performance that make the audience say, oh, I've done that, but I didn't know anyone else ever noticed it, and I've never seen it like identified. That's always a particularly delightful moment, I think, in any movie or play, when you see something and you're like, oh, I've never seen anyone do that before, but I've done that before. That was something that he helped actors do a lot. You know, he had a real gift for taking a clear look at any actor and knowing what they needed, whether it was an interesting analogy to help them understand a moment in that character's life, or whether it was a story from Mike's life that would make something clear to them, or whether what they needed was to be drawn out by Mike to tell stories about their own life until they could find their way to the character. Mike was really willing to, and I think this is a really unique thing among directors then or now, Mike was really willing to customize his approach actor by actor. If he thought you were talented, if he thought you were capable of delivering, he could be really patient with you. He was your ally. He would stay with you for a long time, as long as you weren't lazy and as long as he felt that you had that talent, he would work with you as specifically as you needed in order to help you give the performance he thought you could give.
You mentioned in the book a story where Walter Matthau delivers one of his lines. Walter Matthau was in The Odd Couple, as we know from the movie, but he was also in the Broadway production with Art Carney. And he turned to the audience and delivered a line, and it got a huge laugh, which would seem to be the thing you would want in a comedy, that people would laugh. But Mike Nichols was very upset with him for doing this and told him not to do it again.
Yeah, I think there were two reasons for that. One is that Mike really respected writers. He, you know, some of his most important relationships creatively were with people like Nora Ephron and Neil Simon and Tom Stoppard. He didn't believe that it was a director's job and certainly not an actor's job to rewrite a script. You know, he often said that sometimes a script needed revision, but that nobody was more qualified to figure out what that revision should be than the writer. So that bothered him. But also, in the case of Walter Matthau and The Odd Couple, I think what bothered him was Mike really had an aversion to a cheap laugh or a costly laugh. And I mean, in the case of that ad lib, which did get a big laugh when Matthau looked at the audience, Mike's argument against it was, nobody ever breaks the fourth wall in this play. And if you do it, yes, you're going to get a big laugh in that moment, but it's going to take us 10 minutes to get the audience back. Like, after you do that, the play is going to go on and they're going to spend the next 10 minutes wondering if you're going to do that again. You've thrown them out of the play and you've done it for the sake of a laugh. And Mike's argument in comedies was always, let's figure out the honest way to get a laugh. The goal is not the laugh itself. The goal is generate something truthful on stage and trust the laugh to come when you generate something truthful. And, you know, he really had no patience with actors who were addicted to an audience reaction. His approach to comedy was very, very disciplined. Even many decades after The Odd Couple, when he was directing Spamalot on Broadway, he gave very stern instructions to his cast, which was full of, you know, comic geniuses like Eric Idle and David Hyde Pierce, or, you know, not Eric Idle, but David Hyde Pierce and Tim Curry and Christian Borle and Hank Azaria, all these fantastic actors. He would say to them, avoid the squeak and turn. And what he meant by the squeak and turn was a little thing that you come up with on stage that gets a laugh. And so you hold on to it and do it the next night and the next night and the next night because you're desperate not to let go of that laugh. He said that the minute you find yourself doing something only to get a laugh, get rid of it. If you really need it in your performance, you'll come back to it, but don't get addicted to that. So it's always been really interesting to me that when he was directing drama, Mike was incredibly respectful of the process of actors and whatever they needed, he would try to provide. When he was directing comedy, he was really kind of a drill sergeant. He policed his actors very closely for any kind of cheap or pandering behavior. He took it very, very seriously.
Talking with Mark Harris, and he's just written a new book, Mike Nichols Alive. I guess there's no accounting for taste, but a couple of Mike Nichols movies that I love got terrible reviews and are not well regarded. One of them is Day of the Dolphin, which I really thought was, I liked it a lot. And I also really liked Regarding Henry. I thought that was one of my favorite movies from that period.
You know, it's funny. Mike has had very mixed feelings about some of his movies long after he made them. I mean, when you would talk to him about Catch 22, for instance, which was an ambitious movie, but a commercial failure and pretty much a critical failure when it came out in 1970, there were times when he was somewhat dismissive of it. And there were times when he would open himself up to it a little and acknowledge that there were interesting things in it, and that even if it was not wholly successful, there were things he liked. The Day of the Dolphin, I have to say, is not a movie I ever heard him say a kind word about. I think he felt that he did it for bad reasons, and Buck Henry also always really rolled his eyes at anyone who would attempt to defend it. The funny thing to me about Day of the Dolphin is it's his fifth movie, and his first four were Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Catch 22, and Carnal Knowledge. So
all classics, yeah.
All classics. So if you were a kid growing up in the 70s, as I was, The Day of the Dolphin was the first movie he made that you could see. Like, your parents were not going to take you. Mine certainly weren't when I was, you know, 8 or 9 to any of those other movies. So The Day of the Dolphin was the first Mike Nichols movie I saw. And I probably saw it in an age when I wasn't even particularly attuned to the idea that movies were directed by someone and that the director was in charge. And like, maybe I had heard of Alfred Hitchcock, but that was probably the only director I really knew about. So for a lot of people my age, you know, in our mid 50s, we have a lot of affection for The Day of the Dolphin because it's a movie we grew up with, but Mike had no patience with that at all. He called it the fish movie and just completely had no use for it.
Well, I like it. I don't care. And what about Regarding Henry? That, I thought that was a really good film. I mean, I cried. I've even shown it to some classes. I think it's a really fine. I think the acting in it is really good. I liked the theme of it, and it's a surprising picture.
You know, I never got to ask Mike what he thought of it. According to a number of people who were involved in the movie, it came at a time in his career when he was sort of trying to figure out what he wanted his movies to be about. It happened at a very happy time in his life, soon after he married Diane Sawyer. And I think the theme of the movie probably resonated a lot with him in that it's a movie about a jerk, basically, a bad guy with his priorities all in the wrong place, who, through the sort of accident of a bullet to the head, gets a second chance to sort of become a new, better person. And I think Mike, who was about 60 years old and on his, you know, third divorce and fourth marriage, found the idea of a completely fresh start, a chance to, like, I think he thought that the idea of erasing your sins in this kind of artificial, unearned way was a really interesting thing to explore. But I don't think he ever, and I think he would have said this, I don't think he ever developed the script fully enough so that some of the more biting ramifications of that would be apparent. I mean, the only negative thing I ever heard him say about the movie is maybe it's a little bit soft. And I think what it's missing from that's in a lot of his other work is an edge, a kind of, it doesn't deeply explore the idea that maybe it's not all that possible to completely erase who you were by this, you know, near-death experience / act of fate. So I don't, I mean, It's not a movie of Mike's that I love, although I think there's some really lovely stuff in it. But it was a hard film to write about because I think it's not a movie that Mike is deeply in terms of the content, in a way that I can find him more in a number of his other movies, including movies that failed. Like there are movies that flop that I, you know, a movie like Wolf, for instance, which he made soon after Regarding Henry. Wolf does not work, but half of Wolf is a very Mike Nichols movie. Like I completely understand what he was going after in those scenes. And I feel that I understand why the stuff that doesn't work in Wolf, which is basically the Wolfman stuff, you know, why Mike couldn't quite find his way to that. So it's, you know, it gets back to the question of, is he an auteur? I think, yeah, in a way he is, because even in the movies of his that don't work, for the most part, you can find him.
And of course, it's also about timing, right? I mean, you mentioned in the book that he attended a screening of The Fortune and everybody realized, oh, The Fortune was really a good movie. It just hit at the wrong time and people didn't get it.
Yeah, that was decades later. And I think The Fortune, you know, I think it can be particularly destabilizing to have a movie fail when you had a great time making it and you thought that it was good. I mean, Mike didn't have any high expectations for The Day of the Dolphin. Well before the movie was released, he knew what he thought of that movie. And Catch-22, as soon as MASH came out, which was before Catch-22 opened, he knew that that movie was going to steal his thunder. But The Fortune was a movie he had a great time making, a great time shooting. He had some problems with the screenwriter, but loved working with the actors. And Marsha Mason described a really interesting experience of standing in the back of a theater with Mike where The Fortune was previewing and the audience just wasn't laughing. And she said she thought it was really unnerving for Mike that it does seem to be one of the first times where something he made didn't work and he couldn't quite figure out why. That's always something that's going to shake an artist up a lot, I think.
Well, it is interesting when movies end up having a new life years later. I mean, there is even a bunch of people who think Ishtar was a good movie and was misjudged.
Totally. Totally. And comedies, especially, can kind of get a second wind very, very late in their lives. So I think it's like, if I see The Fortune on cable or something, I always stop and watch it because I don't think it entirely works, but I see Mike in every frame of it, and it's, to me, it's a really interesting and occasionally really fun movie. I mean, I think even people who don't like the movie have to admit that Stalker Channing is fantastic, and it's a peculiar script, and it doesn't really look like a comedy. It looks like if you had the sound off, it looks like a sort of more serious movie from the 70s, something like Robert Altman's Thieves Like Us. It doesn't have the super bright, like sitcom palette of a comedy, but there's a lot to love in The Fortune.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Mark Harris. He's a film historian and journalist. His books include Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, and Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War, which was also a Netflix series. His latest book is called Mike Nichols, A Life. And we'll continue our conversation with Mark Harris right after this. If Mike Nichols had never become a film director or a stage director, he would still be revered for the 10 years that he spent teamed with Elaine May as a comedy team. They recorded several albums. How many albums did they record?
They made three. They made three. One of them was an album of highlights of their Broadway show. And One of them was called, the first one was called Improvisations to Music, which is something that they came up with specifically for a comedy album. And that was a big seller. And then they did one called Nichols and May Examine Doctors, which was a bunch of sort of medical routines that I think was largely taken from this program they did called Monitor, this NBC radio program, where they were hired for quite a long time to come in every second Sunday and just go back and forth with each other and create little routines that could be anywhere from 30 seconds to 5 minutes to be used, you know, in between other programming. And they called a bunch of those. They did something like 400 little bits altogether. Uh-huh. And they called a bunch of those for their final album.
And those records came at a time when it was kind of a golden age of comedy records, when Shelley Berman and Mort Saul and Bob Newhart, all those guys were making their comedy records. And those records were a part of my life.
Well, that was also, you know, the only way that you could listen to your favorite comedy routines over and over and over and over. I mean, there were people who practically memorized those Nichols and May routines word for word because, you know, you didn't have YouTube. You couldn't revisit stuff again and again. So the only way you could kind of own a piece of Nichols and May was to get those records.
And talking on the telephone was something that a lot of comedians did. I mean, people associated, I think, mostly with Newhart, but I'm sure Shelley Berman did it before Newhart did. And
I think Shelley Berman had a lot to say about him doing it before Newhart did. But you know, there's also, I think there's, Shelley Berman once said that, you know, he and Nichols and May were part of the same, that kind of boiling cauldron of Chicago improv comedy in the mid-1950s. And Berman in particular, at one point, really wanted Nichols and May and Berman to become a trio. But Mike was very possessive of Elaine and was not about to sort of share his partnership. And Berman once said that what became one of his signature routines, which was the one-sided phone call, happened in part because he couldn't get Elaine to be on the other end of the phone. that he had to figure out how to make it a solo act.
Well, and you were mentioning earlier the effect that that teaming had on Mike Nichols' view of comedy and of drama as going forward. That I think the thing that Nichols and May share with Shelley Berman is that they were primarily actors who were performing in comedy playlets, I guess you'd say.
Yes, I think that's right. Sometimes it's a mistake to say that Mike Nichols went to the University of Chicago and quickly got into comedy or improv comedy. His interest was acting, and the even the first troupe he belonged to, this group called the Compass Players, which is now famous for being, you know, one of the birthplaces of improv comedy. Their mission initially was not comedy. I mean, some of the sketches they did, many of the sketches they did were either dramatic or topical. They had a real idea of doing sort of revolutionary daily theater springing off the headlines. So I think the comedy happened because Nichols and May were both so naturally funny, and they made, I mean, that's something they said over and over again when they were asked like why they had such an extraordinary connection. Elaine May always says, because we found the same things funny. It was almost like by finding the same things funny, they discovered that they spoke the same language. And by discovering that they spoke the same language, they discovered how they could act with each other and create comedy situations. So that's how they became a comedy team.
Mark Harris, Tony Kushner, the playwright whose play Angels in America was made into a film by Mike Nichols, is your husband, which comes as no surprise to you. You probably already knew that before. but my listeners might not know. So you have a personal connection to this story. I mean, when did you personally, because you don't appear in the book, but You knew Mike Nichols. You met him many times. I mean, were you friends? What was your he was at your wedding?
Yep. I knew Mike during the last, I guess, 12 or 13 years of his life. I met him first in probably 2001, which is when he and Tony started working together on the HBO adaptation of Angels in America. And, you know, the process of Angels was very, very long, because it was a long miniseries and an extremely complicated production. So, you know, from the time that Mike started work on Angels to the time that everybody involved in Angels went to Los Angeles and collected their last awards for it was more than 3 years. So that was a really good long time of getting to know Mike and getting to watch him work. And almost as soon as that was done, I started work on my first book. So having had, you know, many informal conversations with Mike over the years, that's when we sat down for the first time and I actually, you know, brought a recorder with me and interviewed him. So yeah, it was, you know, it was a very tricky thing going in, thinking about, you know, doing a biography of someone who I knew, but in some ways that part of it was easier than I thought, because I realized in a sort of very humbling way that although I felt I had known him for years, Angels in America was going to be chapter 32 in a 35 chapter book. So I knew him for the last four chapters of his really long life. And so when I was researching Mike in Chicago in the 1950s or Mike directing his first Broadway play in 1963 or Mike growing up in New York, a immigrant in the 1940s, I didn't feel like, oh, I know him. I knew him. This is the person I knew. It was really like someone else, because it was, you know, I wasn't even alive for the first however many chapters of the book. And so it only got sort of puzzling emotionally to figure out how to handle it once I got up to Angels in America. And I thought, you know, the whole time I thought, well, do I introduce myself? Do I break the fourth wall? Do I suddenly say, okay, this is where I come in? And ultimately I decided that no, it wasn't necessary. That the best thing I could do for the account of Angels in America and also for the reader was to approach it just like any other section of Mike's life, with the exception of the fact that in this case, I had an extra batch of very specific knowledge of how it went that I was going to freely draw on. And you know, it just didn't feel right to me to stop the book in its tracks to sort of address the reader. And I figured, you know, it's right on the jacket flap that I'm married to Tony and the book is dedicated to him. And so anyone who wants to figure this out can. It's not as if I'm hiding it, but I just felt like, tell the story. That's the job. Tell the story for people who absolutely have no interest in who I am.
Did Elaine May participate in your book?
She did. I was really elated to sit down and be able to interview her, because she has not done a lot of interviews. And she was just especially crucial to this book because, you know, I had the luxury of the fact that Mike had worked with so many people. So if one person from a Broadway show or a movie didn't talk to me, there was a long list of other people I could go to. But there's no list under Elaine May of people like Elaine May. Right. You know, that was an incredibly unique partnership. And no one else from, you know, the period of, say, 1954 to 1963 had the specific knowledge of Mike or the vantage point on his work and his life that she had. So I didn't really let myself think about the question of what I was going to do if she said no. You know, that was something I was afraid to look at, but I'm was very, very relieved when she agreed to talk to me. And I think the book honestly benefits from it, because she has not given many interviews over the last 50 years. And so if you want the only available inside perspective on what that Nichols and May partnership was like, this book has it. I'm really happy about that.
Well, the hardest thing to do in a biography is to bring someone to life on the page, and you do it so well. The book is called Mike Nichols, A Life, and the author, Mark Harris. Mark Harris, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much. I always really enjoy it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.